21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your command.
Come on, people now. Smile on your brother. Everybody get together. Try to love one another right now. Welcome back. 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Cordner. Our engineer is Kristen Hagerick. Our guest tonight is joining us for the second time in less than a year, which is mighty unusual for us on 21st Century Radio. Dr. Joy Porter joined us back in May about her book on Native American Freemasonry, and she mentioned she had a brand new book out about the concepts of land and spirit in Native America, and we were excited to take a look. Now, all we had to do was read the first few pages to know we had to interview her again as soon as possible. The foreword to this book is written by the esteemed Dr. Bruce Johansson, professor at the University of Nebraska, who has also endorsed my books and helped me enormously with my own research into the League of the Iroquois Nation's influence on America's founding fathers. Dr. Johansson wrote that his first reaction to Dr. Porter's subject in this book was puzzlement. He asked himself, place? What did place have to do with Native American history, literature, and culture? But then he gave it a little thought and suddenly realized just about everything. He goes on to say that one of Dr. Joy Porter's premier strengths is that as a European, she can sometimes see the forest for the trees. By the way, advantage I have on the world. I can't see the forest for the trees, as a matter of fact. Through this focus on place, she has been able to delve deeply into the Native American philosophy and has shown us how it could save our future. The big questions she starts with are, what is land? What is space? What is place? Her research reveals these concepts are understood quite differently among our indigenous cultures when compared to our European American societies, and the ramifications are grave when it comes to the environmental pollution. Native Americans live with their environment and as part of it. This is something Americans and all Westerners need to learn if we are to survive the coming generations of environmental turmoil. Indigenous peoples have hundreds of years of experience coping with environmental degradation, population pressure, and spiritual loss. As we will find out tonight, our prejudice against making changes to address climate change are similar to those we used to subjugate the Native Americans since colonization. These prejudices against the environment and the Native Americans both stem from our Western Judeo-Christian conditioning that humans are here to dominate the earth. We're going to cross some boundaries tonight and find ideas for the future that start by valuing rather than supplanting the Native Americans. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Dr. Joy Porter.
Bob, thank you. It's a wonderful interview opening. Thank you. Listening to it, it made me think I should get out more and stop writing these books. I need to get into these places instead of writing about them.
Yeah, I know, but if you didn't write these books, how would we learn?
Well,
I mean, you've done this. This is research that all of us needed years ago.
I'll tell you, this is one of the books in my life where I've learned most through the process of writing, which is why mostly people write books, I think, to teach themselves, selfishly, not really to teach others. But yeah. I learned so much that frightened me and inspired me and that made me think about the immediate future and environmental loss. And I just find it a very rewarding thing to think about.
It certainly is. Well, how has the life of spirit always profoundly informed our approach to land?
I think it has. I think it's something we haven't really been conscious of, and I think as we've become increasingly secular post-Enlightenment, we kind of have been encouraged to forget that our conceptual landscape, the way we think about things, is actually very strongly informed in the West by Judeo-Christian thinking, and that those others, in inverted commas, indigenous peoples of the world and the peoples who don't share a Judeo-Christian viewpoint are similarly informed by their religious, spiritual underpinnings, and that that affects how you look at land, how you use space, how you think about the human relationship to land and to place, what we're here for, how we should be here, how we orientate ourselves relative to places and to nature itself. So I think it's always been there, and it's just not been the focus of academic study yet. But I think increasingly, as the environmental crisis starts to bite more and more, we're going to ask ourselves the questions of how did we get here? What thinking made us get to this position of crisis? And how are we going to think our way out of it? Because we've got to think a different way in order to act a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think these questions are going to become more and more central. Another thing I wanted to say about this book is one of the reasons I wrote it is because I want to take environmental issues and social justice environmental issues away from or add to them, take them out of the scientific realm. I want more people like me, historians, cultural studies writers, literary people who are thinking across disciplinary boundaries. I want them to be accessing this debate instead of the way environmental issues tend to be, where there's just an environmentalist corral and there's scientists who talk about it, and then largely it gets ignored by all the other disciplinary silos. So I want to bring Native American issues, environmental issues, out of those silos and get us all talking about it from multiple perspectives.
Well, we certainly applaud that approach. It was very much needed. One of the most important takeaways from your book is the need to involve community of spirituality in making an effective paradigm shift to save us from climate change. Why is that particularly so for the United States?
I think the United States is a profoundly religious and spiritual nation, and that's always been the case, and there has been a movement certainly since the 80s, 1980s, whereby more and more scholars are looking, people like John Butler and so on, are looking at the spiritual history of America and seeing it as a legitimate topic to look at spirituality in a serious way, as a determinant, motivating factor in how things get done in America. I also think that America is very important to addressing the whole question of climate change. Even if it has to be said federal action in terms of addressing climate change has so far been relatively limited. And I noticed that one of the good things, if there is any good thing about the Sandy phenomena, is at least it brought the issue of climate change into the discourse of the last election. Was really, prior to that, we'd been electing the man who's called the leader of the free world without really thinking hard about the biggest issues pending for all of us. I think some of the biggest issues facing the immediate future are, of course, debt. But the even bigger one, I think, is overpopulation and its links to environmental stress, environmental despoilation, you know, the products of rapid and accelerating industrial use of land. That wasn't really on the election agenda, but I think it's going to have to be, and I think America has a really big role to play globally and just in terms of itself as a nation state in addressing these problems. The U.S. consumes a colossal 25% of global energy, and it pumps out about 20% of the world's carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. So if America doesn't fix it, who's going to? You know, this is a job that's for every single American person to address. And I'm not saying there are easy answers. One of the things about this book is it investigates all the possible answers we could have. But the primary thing it tries to do is overcome the inertia that's stopping us all from doing very much about it. I don't know if you heard of, there's a wonderful academic here in the UK who was in the theatre, and he was in the Royal Court Theatre in London with a show where he replicated his office. I hope it's tidier than the office I'm sitting in now here in the UK. And he basically, he's a computational scientist, and he just presented facts one after the other about the environmental crisis. Things he said included, he said one Google search uses the same amount of energy as boiling a kettle. Google, by the way, have debated this subsequently. But he came up with a litany of other stats that really suggest that things are much more acutely problematic than anyone has thought, and that our remedies are probably completely ineffectual. The recycling we're doing. He suggested, for example, that by the time a 4x4 car is produced, it's used so much energy and caused so much environmental destruction that it really doesn't matter whether you drive it or not. You know, the big problem is front-loaded into the production of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before he started on all the issues of overpopulation. These problems are not simple, and the book explores how unsimple they are and how unsimple the cultural change will be in trying to get people to take these problems seriously and vote and act in such a way as we can somehow address them.
Well, another thrilling part of the book for me was just about you. I'm going to copy a couple of my pages of your book so you can see. You can't even see your writing in it. My writing all over it.
That's a good compliment.
I know by writing all over it has made it a small encyclopedia of knowledge. Now I need an index to my writing all over it because you have so many sources. You may have 10 or 12 sources within a couple of pages. People I've never read or heard about. I don't know how you've been able to accomplish so much reading. I guess you must read a book every 15 minutes or something. I don't know how you do that.
I think one of the things, academic, I've been reading for a living now all my life, and I'm 44. One of the things academic life teaches you is to read with purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a very interrogative reader. You know, so and I think reading efficiently is all about getting the main messages and working out what are the subsidiary messages.
Mm-hmm.
And the subsidiary messages you don't tend to have to pay the same level of attention to.
Well, that's why I don't.
Unfortunately, most writers make it difficult to find out what their main point is. But so I think, you know,
well, yes,
that's the main answer.
that means they can add another 150 to 200 pages to their book.
Well, I think I probably am quite a very careful writer because I tend not to assert things having a body of evidence behind what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't think that making grand. I mean, maybe that's a female thing as well, where we're probably less comfortable with grand assertions.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a sexist remark in itself. But
I think that's truthful, though.
You know, if I can't check your sources, I'm probably going to distrust you.
Of course.
I try and apply the same standards to myself. So.
Yeah. Well, I wish the far right wing of our country would have done that. I don't think they check their sources at all. But that's my bias. We're going to take our first break here. Dr. Joy Porter is our guest, professor of history at Hull University in the United Kingdom. Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com.
Hello, this is Joanne Shenandoah. I'm a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter, Native American Music Award winner, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Now that the longhouses breed superstition, you force us to send our toddlers away to your schools where they're taught to despise their traditions, forbid them their languages, then further say that American history really began when Columbus set sail out of Europe and stressed.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Joy Porter, professor of Indigenous History at Hull University in the United Kingdom. The book is Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page at 21stcenturyradio.com. Joy, what can you say about the particular challenge of talking to American Republican voters about climate change? Is it necessary to get right-wing religious beliefs on board to change human behavior?
Well, when you start thinking about this problem, there's clearly a right-left divide. A majority of American Republican voters are highly religious, as defined by church attendance. And as I cite in my book, there's a 2010 poll that showed that only 16% of Republican voters think climate change is real, caused by human activity and actually dangerous, mm-hmm. compared to, say, over 50% of Democratic voters. So it does look like climate change has been perhaps wrongly divided up as a Democrat-Republican problem. And I think this is, again, a problem with how scientists and others have presented the environment as an issue. Mm-hmm. It's rooted probably in the 60s, this whole notion that the environment is linked to left politics. But I think we've really got to get beyond that and start thinking about this earth as belonging to us all and go back to certain Republican traditions, Christian traditions of stewardship of the land and of stability and community. I think we've got to start having a much more inclusive dialogue about the environment and get away from this notion that this is a left-wing problem that the left discuss, and really it's not the concern of God-fearing, right-thinking Americans. I think that has to be left behind.
Yeah. I'm interested in the huge changes that have occurred in this country in regards to our perspective about land and about nature and about so-called wilderness. I never thought about this, and I can't understand why I never did. What did early Euro-Americans think about the wilderness?
Well, it's not just me who's written about this. It's a wonderful book by William Cronin, an edited collection that was absolutely pivotal and epoch-changing, really. And there's now quite a consensus of thinking among elite historians about wilderness and about it being an artifact, really, as a concept that's changed through time. So early Euro-Americans thought of wilderness the way the Bible thinks about wilderness, which is that it's frightening, barren, dangerous. It's the place where Christ goes to be bewildered. And, you know, and that all goes back to more ancient traditions in Europe of the wild man.
Oh, yeah.
As someone who's Irish, I grew up with this notion of the wild Irish, you know. And that word wild has had a wonderful history within Euro-American thinking. The other, the dangerous, the occult, the sometimes pagan, has been deemed to be wild. And wild is this primitive, this thing that exists outside of settled agriculture, outside of civilization, and it's dangerous, and it's the repository of all our hopes, aspirations, dreams, fears, repressed thoughts, the wild, you know. And if you look at the biblical understanding of it, literally the wilderness is dangerous, it's barren, place Christ goes to be tempted by Satan. You are at peril. You are at spiritual peril in the wilderness. And of course, this had repercussions when Americans find themselves surrounded by forest during the colonial period. They've been conditioned to think of land and landscape that was not settled with settled agriculture, with fences and tilled land, as being dangerous and inherently threatening and something that needed to be dominated and controlled, and the land literally needed to have a human imprint upon it for it to be safe. And all of this has its roots in Christian thinking.
Well, by the early 19th century, wilderness had become less about danger and more about the opportunity to commune with God. Now, this is a big switch. So what happened?
I think the switch is a symptom or not a result, but something that goes along with industrialization. I think as Americans find themselves more and more constrained by the city, they start seeing wilderness as its antithesis. So if the city is stressful, secular, liable to be the place that takes man away from his central self, then the wilderness then becomes something that in itself is a sanctuary that will give you spiritual sustenance. It can be seen perhaps as a portal, another way of accessing the divine on some level. So you get lots of talk of beautiful landscapes as being cathedrals or cathedral-like beauty. And John Muir, for example, talks a lot about the wilderness as his cathedral. And, of course, his religious background, you can see it coming up in his writing, where he's constantly seeing the wilderness as transcendent space. And he's filled with the spirit of wilderness in the same way that people would be filled with the spirit of God. And I think that transition is to do with industrialization. Basically, the wild becomes this crystallized version of what we haven't got. And if we haven't got peace of mind, we look for it outside of civilization.
Well, the belief of Americans regarding the future of the Indian race, and I have a hard time now even saying the word Indian anymore.
Because, race is the one I find difficult because races don't really exist, and, you know.
Well, anyway, it has also changed radically.
Not genetically, anyway, you know.
Yeah. Has also changed radically over the generations. Describe the concept of the vanishing Indian and how at the end of the 19th century things began to change and move towards preservation of the culture.
Yeah, I think the vanishing Indian trope or idea has had great legs over the centuries of American history, this notion that Indians are either have vanished or are just about to vanish. And suddenly they're not going to be there. I mean, even the recent rows over the Museum of the American Indian that was newly created in Washington, they've centered upon certain people believing that actually that story of Indian massacre and so on hasn't been told in that site, and it's as if that history has vanished, and it's as if the vanished have not been given a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they may well have a point. So there's been this ongoing thing in American history that Indians are a temporary issue. So you'll have things like the Dawes Act of 1887 that tries to force Indian peoples to be individual allotment-owning units, because it was felt that they could sort the Indian problem, inverted commas, out in one generation. This could all be very quickly solved. But the truth is, the big picture, is that Native peoples have not disappeared and really will not disappear. And since 1900, at least, the pendulum has swung back in terms of Indian numbers, and population levels have steadily climbed since 1900. And nowadays, Native peoples are amongst the fastest reproducing ethnic groups in the United States. So I can't see that future being particularly negative. The notion of vanishing is one that's tied up very much with this idea that, that Indian culture should be quickly preserved and stuck in a museum or salvaged in some way. Because if they're going anytime soon, we really should gather up whatever's left, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the big story of American history is going to leave them behind, and they won't be there to reproduce their artifacts, their material, their thinking, their spiritual life, whatever it is. And that goes hand in hand with the whole growth of the museum movement, because you need a museum if you think Indians are about to disappear.
No.
And you know that idea keeps ebbing and flowing across time, but certainly things do change as you get into the 1930s, in particular with John Collier and the Indian New Deal. You get less of a sense of Indians about to disappear, more of a sense that they're a permanent segment of the American polity and they need to be assimilated or accommodated in some level.
Mm-hmm. Well, our approach to nature shifted again in the 20th century from transcendent and sublime into the 19th century. Nature became recreational and consumable in the 20th. Hey, that's something America can do well.
We
can recreate and consume. We're good consumers.
We can do that.
I'm sorry. I apologize. How can we improve this perspective by learning indigenous thinking?
Well, I don't think it's the case that indigenous people have all the answers. I don't think it's the case either that indigenous people all think alike, or even that you can identify predominant, necessarily, ideas. But I do think that there are generalities you can meaningfully talk about. And essentially, it's an approach to land that's radically different than the one we've been working on since discovery and before, which is an idea of subjugating and dominating land. Most indigenous thinking talks about living in some kind of reciprocal relationship to land and some kind of kinship relationship to sentient and non-sentient things outside of man, stone, land, water, whatever it is. So it's a much more balance-orientated set of relationships, and it's multiple relationships as well,
mm-hmm.
and it's reciprocal, it's a dialogue. And I think that basic idea is one we should listen to. Also, I argue in this book that the environmental crisis is getting more and more critical. More and more people are experiencing environmental strain, whether it's through natural disasters or impacts on the Gulf Stream or pollution or whatever it is. And Native people have been dealing with these kinds of problems in different ways, in different places, for longer than the rest of us. They are the ones who've been forcibly migrated to difficult terrains where disproportionately there has been pollution and various sorts of environmental stress. So I think in terms of learning about adaptation, which is the big story for the next decades, how to adapt to change, how to live with pollution, how to be part of nature that isn't pristine wilderness but is in fact sullied and polluted and damaged in some way, I think a lot of indigenous communities have lessons that they can teach us, and those lessons are as diverse and as complex as Native peoples are themselves.
So by being informed by indigenous thinking, we all will have the courage to reassess ideas and approaches that were previously taken for granted. That's a point that you made that I think is something I think Americans need to look at again.
I think the big message is if we look at our history with an honest eye, the history of how we've approached the land and how we've approached the people who owned this land before we got here, then I think we will necessarily change our relationships to land.
Mm-hmm.
I think history does change your viewpoint.
Well, our viewpoints now change. We're going to take a break here. But when we come back, we're going to explore further how Christianity completely shaped the European approach to nature and place. I got to tell you, friends, there's not a page in this book that I didn't learn from. I didn't realize that back in the Yellow Submarine days, I would say I had a lot of holes in my education that I had to fill up. And they're filling them up with Dr. Joy Porter's, who is the professor of Indigenous History at Hull University in United Kingdom, Land and Spirit in Native America. Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Would you like to win a free copy of the book we're talking about, Land and Spirit in North America, by Dr. Joy Porter, courtesy of Prager Publishers? 1-800-368-6868. That's 1-800-368-6868. If you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you will win that book. Do you know who was our second hour guest on the 4th of November the last time I hosted the show? Who was our second hour guest on the 4th of November? First qualified caller with the right answer wins. Here's what to do. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
This is Max Dashu of the Suppressed Histories Archives. You're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. For global women's heritages, icons, and video clips, visit www.suppresshistories.net.
When a war between nations is lost, the loser we know pays the cost. But even when Germany fell,
welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Joy Porter, professor of Indigenous History at Hull University in the United Kingdom. Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers, available on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Joy, let's explore further how Christianity completely shaped the European approach to nature and place and how this differs from the Native American approach.
Well, I would say that Indian approaches to land or place tend to see it more as space invested with meaning through lived experience, and also as something defined by its construction rather than its borders. And in comparison, European and later on Euro-American approaches to land have tended to see it through the lens of Christianity, which, as I said earlier, means that American land that's beyond American settlements starts to look like dangerous spiritual space, a place where you could become spiritually and physically lost. And all of this connects to a notion of man's relationship to his spiritual main force. So for the Christian relationship to God is more or less of a father figure. God is more or less human-like, and he's often, certainly in the Old Testament, quite vengeful and a wrathful God, and he's very much like humans. Whereas in Native religions, the supreme authority is placed in a great spirit or a great mystery who's not necessarily anything like humans. Mm-hmm. Instead, that great mystery is a symbol of the life forces of nature,
yeah,
or of the ineffable, what's hard to describe. I mean, so is God within the Christian thinking, but there's certainly more of a human textured picture. I mean, God made man according to the Christian Bible, in his own image. That does not apply within most Native traditions, that idea of man being a mini-me of God, and with all the problems that that gives rise to.
Well, I was having such problems with that. You know, one time I was going to become a priest, and after I fell in love with Lord Bertrand Russell back then.
Really?
Yes. And
fascinating.
In the 50s and the 60s. I mean, I just love this man.
Did I tell you I've been doing work on his milieu?
No.
My next book is all about... a poet who hung out with Bertrand Russell. He was Native American, or he said he was. And Ottilyn Morrill, that daughter of a thousand earls.
Oh, my.
In Garsington. And I've been to Garsington and hung out with its present owners. And the place has hardly changed since the days when Bertrand Russell and Ottilyn would discuss the meaning of spiritual life and science.
Well, I got to tell you, Bertrand Russell changed my life totally. I mean, at first,
you
of course...
You might like this next book, then.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, but this is hard to
believe. Why did he change your life, Bob?
Yes, because it had a... Basically, because after I read Why I Am Not a Christian,
right.
You know, it shocked me. I didn't, you know, at first I didn't like to hear this kind of stuff. And then when I started to apply it to, later on, the Dead Sea Scrolls... And the Gnostic teachings that came about, and well, you know, those things were found in 45. The others were found, I believe, in 47. And I brought this up to the hierarchies within the church. That I realized, first they told me, nope, these are forgeries. Second, they told me, no, you don't have to worry about it because they were 200 A.D. and not B.C., so they're not even applicable. Well, after I got through them... And then I started settling down into Russell's other great works, of which he has many. I think I don't have every book he's ever written, but I've got 30 or 40.
Wow.
And he just gave me the strength in the area of I understood that one could be, say, for instance, a logical positivist and have an ethical, moral outlook on life that was fair and just. And I appreciated that. I really did.
Yeah, it's a great lesson that spirituality is not the exclusive preserve of received religion.
Yeah.
And neither is morality or justice-based thinking.
That's right. That's right. And of course, that led me into my studying and working with other scholars in this particular area, and especially... those at Johns Hopkins University, who were certainly back in the late 60s, early 70s, far more broad-minded than they are today. That's all I'll say about that. I've had a lot of fights with them. Now, whoa, the Age of Enlightenment. Now, here is also something that was so important to me, but I knew there were some problems with it, but I couldn't put my finger on it. But the Age of Enlightenment did wonders for breaking the molds of a powerful, corrupt church dominating every aspect of life. Enlightenment philosophy also led to the advent of republican democracy around the world, but it also contributed to some not-so-good trends. How did Enlightenment philosophy lay the groundwork for the 20th century belief that nature is consumable?
Well, I guess this goes back to Locke. And the notion that nature is primarily for man's benefit. So the opposite of many indigenous traditions where we're in a reciprocal and equal and balanced, we should be in a balanced relationship with nature. Locke really puts forward this idea that nature exists for our benefit. You can also trace this famously back to Bacon's thinking. He talked, you know, this is well known, he talks about the vexation of the earth and that it was okay to use and dissect the earth, really, in the same way that the human body was being dissected at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that connects back, that thinking, you can link it to the biblical project of recovering, through man's agency, the paradise of the lost Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that's worth moving about a lot of the language of these Enlightenment thinkers. And you can still hear it today, actually, in many post-Enlightenment thinkers who are talking about how we might further exploit nature
mm-hmm.
and talk about that as a good thing. It's riddled with a certain kind of misogyny. It's very gendered language. We know this. You know, there's a wonderful writer called Carolyn Merchant who writes, who's explored these ideas and the metaphors, the rape of Lavande and so on. But you can trace a lot of it back to the Enlightenment era.
Well, one of my demigods was and still is, in a way, Thomas Jefferson in regards to Enlightenment. But there's a side of him that I deplore. As much as I love him, the whole idea of how lands could be extricated from the Indians, Native Americans, or he would refer to them as Indians at that time, was just such a depressing thing for the quality of consciousness that he had. To fool them into, I better back out of this. I'm getting carried away here. But you know, he was, as far as Enlightenment went, he was, anything in the past 30 years, anything he said, as far as I was fine. Then after checking into how he treated the Native Americans, especially my favorite, one of them, who wasn't a Native American, but Benjamin Banneker, an African American, was just deplorable. It was very unfair. So I better keep quiet from now on, because we're not going to get through so many of these questions if I keep... You excite me, Joy.
And oh, dear. That effect?
Well, it does to me, and unfortunately, it's not good to be excited.
I think there is a book by Anthony Wallace all about Jefferson and the Indians.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read that.
And it's a wonderful book, and it explores Jefferson really exclusively through his approach to Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, Anthony Wallace is one of the big players in Native American studies. And this book came out with Harvard Press, I think, in 2001. And everything you ever wanted to know, basically, is in there, in case you or your listeners are interested. I don't know if you've come across that.
No, I heard the name, but I didn't explore in that area, and I should have. That's one of the problems of having to read 3 and 4 books a week at times. It really can get me. But
well, there's another one
you.
For your list.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And I'll make sure I check into that, because I need I'm trying to balance out in this particular regard. I just have such an emotional feeling towards all indigenous people and all individuals that basically are below, especially in the area of struggling to become middle class, and are going to have a mighty hard time doing it when the billionaires get done with them.
There's a wonderful jurist within the field of Native American jurisdiction, Felix Cohen. And he said a wonderful quote. He said, how the Native American is treated is the canary in the mine.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
the barometer of how democracy is working in the United States. So if you're concerned about Native Americans or any group that have suffered, you're really concerned about yourself, because how we treat Native Americans is indeed the barometer of how healthy our democracy is, and our democracy mm-hmm. is what has sustained the United States and will into the future. And I think you're absolutely right to be selfish in that sense, because their suffering is our suffering, ultimately, I think.
Yeah, certainly is. Of course... Well, I'm not going to get into other lives and other times. I better break off here. How did the advent of science change our opinions about God as being separate from the nature he created and over which he gave man dominion?
So science, which has its great push with the Enlightenment era, it's interesting because its roots, science's roots are actually in the occult and the non-Christian and the pagan. You think of Newton and so on, who are dabbling in various sorts of alchemy and so forth. But actually, as science grows and develops, it works to separate the sacred off from everything else in life. God starts to a greater or lesser extent being thought about as being separate from the very thing he created. And, you know, this has ended, I don't know what it's like in the United States for you, but for me, you know, spirituality has come to be something you do on a Sunday. Weber, I think, talked about this, where, you know, we've split off our spiritual life into one day. We don't become these Sunday morning Christians or Sunday morning spiritual thinkers. So that whole process whereby spirituality that used to be pervasive, that used to be part of everyone's life and thinking, with the rise of science, starts to become separated off, corralled, and given its own sphere. Following the Enlightenment, you know, that process, which is already working, gets heavily bolstered by Western science. And one of the things this book talks about is how that split is piecemeal and raggedy, and it comes and goes. And, you know, recently we all probably celebrated Halloween. I think that's evidence of that raggedy nature of a past, more pagan reality bleeding through into a scientistic present. And it's similarly, you know, if you look into the past, you don't see a straight line. Whoops, there's the Enlightenment. Now we're not going to think about the life of the spirit. It's not like that. But there is a gradual shift. The wonderful writer Keith Thomas, who talks about the disenchantment of the world that happens, you know, from the 17th century in particular, where we stop seeing the world as an enchanted space, and it becomes something that's material, measurable, quantifiable, malleable, and controllable. Something, the world becomes something over which we have dominion. And that process has probably not been an entirely positive shift. And I think we have to connect it to the whole environmental problems we're dealing with today. When you start to put your spiritual life in a box and see it as something you just deal with on a Sunday morning, and you stop seeing the world as spiritual and every part of the fabric of your day and your relationships as spiritual, then I think something gets lost.
Well, we have lost a great deal, and obviously in the process, hopefully through our study and research into indigenous nations of our planet, perhaps we'll be able to revive it in a shorter period of time than I had thought. We're going to take our final break here of this hour on 21st Century Radio with our guest, Dr. Joy Porter, professor of indigenous history at Hull University in the United Kingdom, Land and Spirit in Native America, Prager Publishers, available from the link on the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Make sure you get a copy of this book. It's extremely important. We'll be back in just a little while.
Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio. I'm Lisa Lissandra.